So we've covered death and destruction around the world, domestic violence at home, but stay with us. We have some good news to report. Blue whales, once considered threatened with extinction, are now doing very well off the coast of California. That's according to a recent study out of the University of Washington, co-authored by Trevor Branch.
What we found was that although whaling knocked them down to fairly low levels, now they've rebounded and they're back at close to their original abundance.
California blue whales range all the way from Alaska to Costa Rica, but they were devastated by whaling. Now, according to the study, they are back to 97% of their historic levels, about 2,200 whales. The findings were based on a complex computer analysis that factored in previous and current populations and potential threats. They also had to figure out how to distinguish the California blue whale population from other blue whales that look exactly the same.
The key piece of information was to use the songs these blue whales make, which are unique to the two populations, to separate out where the populations live, and from that, to separate out the catches.
So you can tell which whales come from where based on their regional accents.
Exactly. Or maybe a slightly separate language, depends on how you word it. From that, you can piece out who's making the calls. Does it sound like an east population or does it sound like a western population?
Now, since the study was published, some scientists have questioned whether it maybe paints too bright of a picture that, for example, whaling fleets always underreport their catches, so there could actually be a greater threat from commercial fishing. What's your response to that?
We looked at a lot of different, what we call sensitivities. So you can run the model in different ways and see how much of a difference it makes. Even if you add 20% to the catches that we have in the model, we still say that the population's more than 90% of what was there before whaling.
Now, you were looking specifically at the population of California blue whales. Is there anything that we know about how blue whales across the world are doing, or whales in general? Does this reflect a broader recovery?
Sadly, they don't reflect a broader recovery in blue whales. This is the bright spot, as it were. Globally, they're still at pretty low levels. It's probably somewhere between 5 and 10% of what used to be there. In some places, it's really, really bad. So in the Antarctic, we caught 99.85% of the Antarctic blue whales before we stopped whaling. Whereas off the west coast of the U.S., they just weren't making enough money to keep on whaling.
With this population of California blue whales, was this a case of nature just basically being left to recover on its own, or was there a stronger conservation push here?
The key here was we stopped whaling, and the whaling was at such levels, I mean, some years they were catching more than 20% of the entire population in a single year. There is one more factor, which is that currently we're killing blue whales. We're not whaling them, but we're hitting them with ships, and the ships are 1,000 times bigger than a blue whale, and so there are lots of people trying to reduce the number of deaths from ship strikes. And all of these efforts, I think, have paid off. You know, that it's a conservation success story.
Trevor Branch is an assistant professor in aquatic and fishery sciences at the University of Washington. He's co-author of a study on the resurgence of California blue whales. Trevor, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
This summer, many Midwestern lakes had a toxic algae problem. In August, it became so bad in Toledo that it had to impose a drinking water ban. Some expected the Toledo experience to be a wake-up call, but as Lewis Wallace of member station WYSO reports, the state of the drinking supply in the region may get worse before it gets better.
6 weeks since the shutdown, a lot of Toledo residents find themselves still drinking bottled water. Residents like Asya Talabdin and Kenesha Gregory.
I won't drink the water because even though they said it was safe, I don't believe them. I'll shower in it, but I won't drink it.
We're on the street just a couple miles from the city's treatment plant, where Andy McClure, the plant manager, shows off giant gray vats of lake water. It's getting mixed up with chemicals that bond with the blue-green crud.
This is a flocculation basin. You know, it's a big enough clump you can actually see it there, and you can start to see it separating from the water.
But the causes of the toxic bacteria start hundreds of miles from here. The algae is fed by natural and commercial fertilizers from all over the watershed, from farms, livestock, and city sewers. All that gathers in the shallowest part of Lake Erie, the Maumee Bay, and as the water warms, the bacteria go wild. But Tim Murphy, Toledo's head of water treatment, says right now a lot of the fixes are happening right here, on the treatment side. He says the city's spending about $1 million a month to keep this water drinkable.
we're treating symptoms of a bigger problem. And we need to get to the bigger problem or else we're going to keep having this battle. And not just us, but every drinking water facility located in the Western Basin is going to have this problem, and probably others. So,
and others do have this problem already. Small lakes all over the Midwest have been getting clogged with algae in the warm summer months. The solutions, though, are a patchwork. Ohio farmers are working on a fertilizer certification program. Cities are trying to get the funds they need to fix their sewer systems. And researchers are trying to pinpoint the sources of the nutrients that feed the green slime. Sandy Binn with the environmental group Lake Erie Waterkeeper says since the problem is regional, the solution should be too. She's looking through her living room windows out at the lake.
If you see that lighthouse out there, just on the other side of that is Michigan.
Indiana and Ontario are also part of the picture. But right now there's no clear central leadership on the issue. Binn wants to see something more like what the Chesapeake Bay has in place, a federal plan for recovery run by the EPA.
It's multi-jurisdictional. And that's why I say the federal government needs to step up.
And there's something else that crosses state lines: climate change. More intense rains make runoff harder to avoid, and warmer waters stimulate more algae growth.
You want to lower this in the water, just like the last?
Last week, a group of scientists took Ohio's Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown out on a pontoon boat to look at the algae. The water's choppy and blue, but the green goo is still there below the surface. A water sample comes out.
Vegetable smoothie.
Scientist Chris Winslow with Ohio State says most of the nutrient runoff in a given year can happen during just a few big storms.
It's happening in these very short pulse windows that are associated with these severe storm events.
He and the other scientists patiently explain that any solutions could take a while. The nutrients already in the water are pretty hard to get out, and the changing climate makes all this even more difficult. Along with Ohio's Republican Senator Rob Portman, Senator Brown introduced two bills last week. One would create a federal database for research, and the other would set federal drinking water standards for the toxins.
When 500,000 people lose their drinking water, and there's no reason we won't see other big algae blooms in the next 5 or 10 years, and the climate is changing, there is not time for delay.
But delay is in the forecast. A program that requires Ohio farmers to get certified before they put down fertilizer is now law, but that won't go into full effect for 3 years. For NPR News, I'm Lewis Wallace.
In coastal places, some communities are rethinking their proximity to water in light of rising sea levels.
The choices are straightforward, but not easy. Defend the shoreline with flood walls and the like, or retreat. Stop development along the water, even remove what's already there. Reed Noss calls that process a managed retreat. He's a Florida biologist.
Noss says as seas rise, plant and animal life are adapting, migrating. Mangrove trees, for example, are moving to higher ground.
There is a natural retreat going on, and you can actually see it. It looks like they're literally marching in on their stilt-like prop roots. They're coming right into what was pine forest and other natural communities being invaded by these mangroves. This is a natural phenomenon.
Reed Noss says cities should take a hint.
If the natural communities are shifting, that should tell us something. Maybe we ought to shift the location of our communities as well.
Well, one city wrestling with this problem is Satellite Beach, Florida. NPR's John Hamilton went to take a look.
When I arrive in Satellite Beach, the surf is definitely up. Short boarders are carving across head-high waves. The ocean is so loud it almost drowns out the cicadas in this beachside park. I'm here to meet Dan Ryder. He's a longboarder who lives a few miles north.
You came on a really good day, actually, because Hurricane Cristobal is out there, and it's sending some heavy chop.
Ryder's 37. He used to live in Tampa. Then he discovered the surf breaks along this stretch of coast south of Cape Canaveral. He moved here for the lifestyle.
It's one of the most beautiful places in the world to live and surf and raise your kids.
Satellite Beach is so wholesome and family-oriented that locals refer to it as Mayberry by the Sea. But there's trouble in this coastal paradise. It's on a low-lying barrier island that's getting lower as sea level rises. So communities are trying to adapt. I ask Ryder whether he thinks they'll succeed.
The idea of planning is really important to lengthen how long we can stay here. But, you know, in the end, it's the same as, you know, living on a fault line or just living in general. You know that you're going to die at some point.
For a more optimistic view, I drive a mile inland, almost to the Banana River on the other side of the island.
All right, City Hall.
Nearly 11,000 people live in Satellite Beach.
You can go back.
Thank you.
Courtney Barker is the city manager.
How are you?
She says erosion and sea level rise have been a hot topic here since 2004. That's when a pair of hurricanes scoured away the beach, damaged several properties, and destroyed a waterfront home.
You know, when that house went into the water, that was very surprising to people.
Barker pulls out a government flood map to show me where the damage occurred.
This is Shell Street. It's right there at the south end of our city, and it's a pretty popular beach access.
The map shows several areas designated as vulnerable to flooding.
I'm going to find an aerial.
About half the land in Satellite Beach is less than 6 feet above water. The most dire projections put some neighborhoods underwater within a few decades. Barker says that's something the city can't ignore.
We have evidence of coastal erosion, and we have flooding during rain events that has gotten worse, you know, and that's pretty much where we're at. We're at a point of where we recognize that we may have a problem in the future, and we need to sit down with the public and hash out a way to address it.
The question is, how? At one extreme, the city could simply retreat, abandoning structures in harm's way or moving them to higher ground. Unfortunately, there's not much higher ground available. At the other extreme, it could armor the coast with seawalls and levees and dikes. Trouble is, the ground here is so porous that water would still seep in. So next week, Satellite Beach will hold a public meeting to start debating how it can become more resilient. A couple of blocks from City Hall is a dock where I meet two people. They know a lot about the city's past and are trying to ensure its future.
Hi, John Hamilton.
Hey, John. Nice to meet you.
One of them is Randy Parkinson, a coastal geologist. The other is John Fergus, a volunteer who has encouraged the city to begin planning for sea level rise. We step onto a pontoon boat, and Fergus steers us into a network of waterways.
Where we are right now used to be palmetto scrub. It's now a canal, and where those houses are was mangrove swamp.
In other words, this is all man-made. We glide north, past Mediterranean-style waterfront mansions, as well as older and simpler homes along the finger canals. Many of the houses are just a few feet above the high tide line. Fergus tells me this kind of development was pioneered in the 1920s by Charles Rhodes. He's the man who transformed Fort Lauderdale swampland into the Venice of America.
His solution was to take a dredge, make a canal, dump the spoil next to the canal, and just like here, you magically then took low-lying swamp and you elevated the land, but not only did you have buildable land, it was waterfront land.
That's what happened here in the 1950s and 60s. Randy Parkinson, the coastal geologist, says a natural coastline retreats as sea level rises. Dunes move inland, so do the mangroves and wetlands. But he says a man-made subdivision can't do that.
When I first came up to this area from Miami, I tried to find a wetland that had not been altered by human activity. But there are no natural habitats left.
In Satellite Beach, almost every buildable lot is occupied. The beaches are covered with sand brought in by truck. Even the city's nature park is on a man-made island. Parkinson says this highly artificial landscape is common in Florida. And he says it's a big problem in an era when the sea is rising and storms may be getting more powerful.
I see a train wreck.
And is Satellite Beach going to be part of that train wreck?
All indications are right now that it's trying to avoid that.
I ask how, and Parkinson takes me back to the seaside park where I talk to the surfer. He says this is where Satellite Beach is doing something very smart. About 15 years ago, it acquired a half mile of coastline from an owner who'd been planning a condo. Parkinson says the city had a better idea.
Behind us is the dune, which would be the highest natural elevations.
He says the city rebuilt the dune, then protected it by planting sea oats and building a wooden crossover for beachgoers.
This has essentially been restored. It is a buffer between the Atlantic Ocean energy and your urban landscape behind.
Parkinson says maintaining that buffer will give people here time to figure out what to do next. Dan Ryder, the surfer who fell in love with this stretch of coast, says he's not leaving anytime soon, but he doesn't expect to stay forever.
Let's just put it this way. My daughter's 7, and I'm not planning on leaving her the house as a legacy. So when she's 40 and 50 years old, I think we're probably going to be somewhere else.
John Hamilton for the NPR Cities Project.
Maybe somewhere in Virginia, up on a mountain or on some high ground, on a ridge somewhere.
But not the Virginia beaches.
No. I'm thinking about...
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, we'll hear about an aggressive effort to move people away from the ocean in New York City.
And we want your stories and photos of nature reclaiming urban space. Maybe a tree flourishing in an abandoned house, a backyard turned fox den, a crack in a sidewalk brightened by a flower.
Give us a glimpse of what's happening in your hometown of nature making itself known. You can do it through Twitter, Tumblr, or Instagram. Use the hashtag #NPRCities.
50 years ago, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Wilderness Act into law. Now, 109 million acres of land are under federal protection. For hikers, campers, and rafters, the wilderness is their playground, far from roads, cars, and commercial enterprise. But as Samantha Wright from Boise State Public Radio reports, for some struggling rural towns, those off-limits landscapes represent untapped resources.
Alyssa Benedict is about to head out for her morning ride from the Mystic Saddle Ranch in central Idaho.
I usually start out with an hour ride to sort of get my sea legs and then go on a longer ride, and it's great.
Every summer, Benedict and her husband travel from Ann Arbor, Michigan, to vacation in Stanley, Idaho, the doorway to the Sawtooth Wilderness area. Wilderness means roads, logging, and motorized vehicles are not allowed, and the landscape is left mostly untouched.
It means fresh air. It means being able to see the stars at night. It means just sort of relaxing and taking things at your own pace and enjoying yourself.
Congress passed the Wilderness Act in 1964. The goal was to preserve and protect lands in their natural condition. The tiny town of Stanley is surrounded by such land. Both the Sawtooth Wilderness Area and the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness are part of the nearby landscape. Deb Bitten and her husband own Mystic Saddle Ranch, and the wilderness is their livelihood. Her 65 horses take riders deep into Idaho's Sawtooth Mountains, traveling to places few people ever see.
When you get in there, there's a certain amount of grandeur and a certain amount of just awe that you don't get any other way. You know, it really is hard to describe the magnificence of the backcountry.
The wilderness is beautiful, but the land is not earning its keep, says Custer County, Idaho Commissioner Doyle Lamb.
We can't do any logging. We can't do any mining. It's hard on our economy. It really is. Wilderness is hard on our economy.
Lamb lives an hour away from Stanley. His county is huge, almost 5,000 square miles, but 97% of that is federal land, including wilderness. None of that land can be taxed, and Lamb says that means the county is losing potential revenue. Almost 19% of people here live below the poverty level. Meanwhile, it's the county that pays to maintain the roads that lead to protected areas. And Lamb says it's the county that has to respond and foot the bill when someone gets hurt in the backcountry.
Because we're strictly volunteer and we have no paid EMS or search and rescue. So when they call us out, it's hard on the county.
Lamb says most people who use the wilderness are dependent on guides and packers to get around. He says only the wealthy can afford to venture into what he calls a rich man's playground. But back in Stanley, the town's mayor, Herbert Mumford, says it's mostly mom-and-pop businesses that make up the backbone of the local economy, and he believes they're not doing it just for the paycheck.
It hasn't made us rich, but it certainly enriches our lives in ways that transcend money.
Mumford knows his town is missing out on jobs and taxes, but he says the people in Stanley have found a balance, both living and working in the wilderness areas that surround them. For NPR News, I'm Samantha Wright in Boise.
Brazil's presidential election is coming up, and polls show two women in a close race for the top spot. One is the incumbent, Dilma Rousseff. The other is a former environment minister, Marina Silva. Silva is running as a socialist, but if she wins, she will be the greenest president of a major economic power. So why aren't environmentalists happy? NPR's Lourdes Garcia Navarro reports from Sao Paulo.
Marina Silva walks into a repurposed factory in central Sao Paulo to an upbeat campaign tune, which goes in part, her last name is Da Silva, she's from the selva, or forest in English. Marina Silva doesn't come from the centers of power on the coasts of Brazil, but rather grew up the poor daughter of Amazon rubber tappers. A longtime environmentalist, she was a colleague of the murdered rights activist Chico Mendes. She became a senator, the youngest ever elected at the time, and then she was appointed environment minister under former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Described by admirers as a person of strong personal conviction, she ended up quitting over disputes about environmental protections and controversial dam projects. Now Silva has a chance to win the top job herself in the country after her running mate Eduardo Campos was killed in a plane crash last month. Polls show her possibly beating the incumbent.
Nossa querida Marina Silva, presidente do Brasil.
At this campaign event, NPR asked Silva if she will be the first green president of Brazil if elected.
Me vejo como a primeira presidente socioambientalista.
I see myself as the first social environmentalist president. What that means is someone who integrates economics and ecology, conservation and social justice. I'm smiling as I say it. I am imagining if Chico Mendes were still alive to see it.
The possibility that a woman with such strong credentials could be the next president of Brazil should be good news for environmentalists here, right? Not so fast.
They are optimistic with Marina, but I think there is a lot of skepticism as well.
Luiz Cruz Villares is from Brazil's Sustainable Amazon Foundation. He says the first worry is that even with the best intentions, Marina Silva won't have the clout to get things done. Her party is a small one. She wasn't even its first choice, but only got the top spot after the death of the main candidate. She would have to build consensus, he says.
She would have to be backed by a very large portion of society. And that comes, in my opinion, the very first challenge of her government.
A government like that would necessarily have to make compromises. Environmentalists note with concern that she's already been courting agro-business leaders and has dialed back her vocal opposition to genetically modified crops, Brazil's deep seabed oil exploration, and other environmental issues. Pedro Teles from Greenpeace in Brazil says that the Brazilian reality is that you have a massive economy based around agriculture and fossil fuels, with strong political congressional support for those industries.
The biggest challenge we have now in Congress is the ruralist front, which represents the interest of big agricultural producers, pushing forward regressive legislation in terms of allowing more degradation of the environment.
All of the environmentalists I spoke with say that Brazil, which had been an example of strong environmental protections, has seen those rolled back in the past few years. Vilmar Berna is an environmental activist. He says Marina Silva could really change things for the better. Our hope with Marina is very big, he says. But when I asked him if he'll vote for her, he says he still doesn't know. I don't think any one person can save this country, he says. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News, Sao Paulo.